Hello and welcome to Rooted. Now, this episode is for you if you have ever wondered what goes on in the boardroom and how it really feels to work within a boardroom as a non-executive director or as a chair. And it may also be for you if you have contemplated a career within the boardroom or building a portfolio career later in life. I would love you to listen to this episode. It's going to give you a great insight into what it really feels like to lean into the G of ESG. Because this week I've got Lisa Tennant joining me on the podcast, and I'm calling her the Queen of Governance because her career is amazing. She's such a role model. The conversation, I really think you're going to enjoy it, and I'd love to hear what you think. So let's go. I'm joined today on Rooted by someone who absolutely epitomizes the impact you can have in a portfolio career. Now, Lisa Tennant is a board chair, a non-executive director, and an independent reviewer, amongst lots of other things. She's clocked up over 10,000 boardroom hours and started her first NED role at just the age of 34. So amongst her current roles, she is chair of the NHS Pension Board, she's chair of the Scottish Environmental Protection Agency, SEPA, and she's a NED at Smart Energy GB. She has a background as a tech entrepreneur working in the world of circular economy, and she now works across financial services, pensions, utilities, mission-led companies, amongst other areas of interest. Reading her CV, I was struck by she just is the absolute queen of governance. So welcome to Rooted, Lisa Tennant.
Thank you very much. I'm going to steal that, queen of governance.
Yes, I was like, I read your LinkedIn profile, and I was like, this is queen of governance. Perfect. We need somebody for the G part of the ESG on this podcast. So it's really good to have you here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And I know that our listeners on Rooted are often listening to the podcast, thinking about their careers. And so I'm really interested in hearing about the portfolio career that you've created. It's often considered as a sort of later career chapter, but actually you've done that a bit differently. And, you know, I think it's you've really leaned into that through the whole body of your career, as far as I can see, or at least your more recent parts. And so I'm really interested in hearing how you've done that and how you find that work. So we'll hopefully get into that as the conversation progresses, if that's all right.
Yes, definitely happy to talk about it.
Let's make a start. And I guess just remembering that on this podcast, we really are talking about the human side of doing this kind of work and how it really feels rather than the more technical content. And I'm really interested, where did your roots in this work begin? What kind of drew you to this type of career?
Oh, it's a really good question. So I think I start in my childhood, and I grew up on a council estate in a coal mining town in Scotland. Mm. And I don't know if a particularly privileged upbringing, but one thing that I always did have were parents who loved the natural world and were very keen to take me out in that. So I remember a lot of childhood day trips with parents, grandparents, extended family, to maybe to swim in the local river. My dad taught me to swim there, to look at the butterflies, to go on a nature walk. I had grandparents who told me the names of every plant in the garden.
Oh, wow, lovely.
And I think probably that's where it came from. You know, some of the surroundings were actually quite grim.
Right, and yeah.
That ability to go somewhere else, we would go to the beach, and, you know, I just got so much out of that. I always had this great love for it. But I think that that great love was really, it was passed down to me.
Yeah, and a love for this is in Scotland. Yeah, you grew
in
up
Scotland,
in, and
yes.
So and a love for the wild environment in Scotland, which then, I mean, full circle really with you now working at and leading the board at Scottish Environmental Protection Agency. I mean, that must feel quite a full circle moment.
Oh, 100%. And that was my dream job. You know, that was my dream chair job.
Yeah,
and I quite often used to drive. So the SEPA head office is a big glass building halfway down the motorway between Glasgow and Edinburgh. And I would drive past it and I would see this big glass building and I'd think, I really want to work there. I really, really want to work there. You know, for years I thought, if only I could have that office. If only my office could be there. And although it sits on the motorway, it looks out over the hills. Really beautiful and very lots of green space. And so when that role came up, I was so excited about it. And, you know, really, it was a dream come true for me to get it. And still, when I drive into work and I go into my office, I think, oh, I'm in the big glass building that I looked at so many times. What a privilege to do that.
There's such a lovely story of yeah, like dreaming big as well. You know, you drive past it, this is where I want to work, and then really, yeah, kind of getting back through to it. And those early childhood experiences, how did they kind of, I guess, coalesce into your career, the beginning of your career? You know, did that drive you down an academic path into this work, or was it a different route that you came into it from?
So I had a very non-traditional route. I come from a non-traditional background and I left school when I was 16. School and I did not get along. And, you know, in my adult years, I was diagnosed with ADHD and autism. And looking back, I think that's probably why school and I didn't get along. And it's so common now for us women in midlife to get this later diagnosis. I mean, my daughter's had a much earlier diagnosis, thankfully. So I think that's quite a common experience now and kind of made me revisit everything about my childhood to think, oh, maybe that's why this was like this. That's why that was like that. Aside from nature, I always had a huge affinity with animals. And I think, again, that's something in common with a lot of autistic people. We can make that really non-judgmental relationship with animals and nature. And so when I left school, I went to work in animal welfare. I had volunteered in animal shelters and I built up a first career in that. I travelled all over the world, working in animal welfare, lived in lots of different countries, and ended up working for RSPCA down in England. After I had done all my travels, I became a branch manager for the RSPCA.
And do you know, I find very often actually on this podcast, I talk to leaders in this world who have had a lot of travel experience that's kind of, you know, they've had a career which hasn't necessarily been in this sort of you know, in environmental work or social work. It maybe has, but they've been drawn to traveling and kind of experiencing the world in different ways, and then they've brought that back into their career, and that somehow seems to make them, yeah, either more driven and or, you know, just more kind of successful and impactful in the work. Do you think it's had an impact, that travel that you did?
I think it really opened my eyes to other cultures, and animal welfare can be really tough work as well. And seeing so many things, so many difficult things at such a young age, I think gave me a lot more resilience also. At one point, I was an animal welfare inspector working in Dublin. I mean, I was really quite still young, and I would go out by myself in my van, go on calls, turn up at someone's door, and have to work my way into someone's house to see what was going on with their animals. You know, when I look back on that, I think, oh, I was quite young to be doing that. So, absolutely, 100%. Give me so much perspective on other people's lives, on how to get things done, on how to build relationships. And then obviously it was just fantastic experience. You know, I spent time in Greece, I was in Borneo, I was in the Bahamas at one point. So yes, fantastic experiences, I think.
Amazing. Yeah, really, and really helpful by the sounds of it too. I'm interested if you could pick out a couple of the real highlight moments as the things that you're most proud of. You've already talked about the role at SEPA and that feeling of I'm in the office that I've been driving past all these years. What else do you feel really proud of as you look back on the work that you've done?
Oh, that's a good question. I think a few things stand out for me. I set up my own business in the circular economy. You mentioned that earlier. That for me, I feel really proud of. My father was an entrepreneur and he set up a business which lifted our whole family out of poverty and really was my biggest inspiration. And so following in his footsteps and setting up that business is something that I'm really proud of, particularly because it was a circular economy business. And so it really fitted with my values.
Yeah.
So I think that, and then again, my, you know, my father's a recurring theme in my life. After I sold that business, I became CEO of a public-private partnership. And I was asked to come and be CEO of this public-private partnership. And I thought, I don't know. I don't know about the public sector side of this so much. And I went to do it. It was a really fantastic job. It was very challenging. And it was the first time that I had had to integrate those two worlds together and be the bridge between those two worlds. And I just found I had a real skill for that, for translating what people on each side of that equation were looking for.
Mm.
So very much enjoyed that role. And then I think I'd been a couple of years into that, my father became terminally ill. And I just thought, I can't work in this 80 hours a week job,
right, yes,
and look after my father.
Yeah.
My family's one of my core values. And luckily at that point, I was approached by the chair of the local NHS board, who knew the work that I was doing in the public-private partnership, and said, we need people like you in the NHS. We need people like you to sit on boards, people who understand how to drive some pace and direction into the public sector.
Mm.
So I agreed to go onto that NHS board and obviously went through a public appointments process. I was quite an unusual hire at that time for boards. You know, this I was 33 at the time, I think.
Okay.
Quite an unusual hire for that. And I had no experience whatsoever of being a non-executive director sitting on a board.
So you didn't go through one of these, like, there's all these programs now, isn't there,
yeah,
where you can sort of, you know, yeah, get your head around the what it means to be a NED and prepare yourself. And but you went straight in.
I went straight in.
Yeah.
And further from that, I started appointed on this board, and the chair said to me, I'd like you to chair the Information Governance Committee. And I said, oh, okay, whatever you need me to do, thinking I have no idea how to do that. And the NHS is this huge structure, you know, we've a very big NHS board. I went to my induction thinking this will give me some clues on how to chair the Information Governance Committee. And I was sent to the induction for all the new staff. So the hospital cleaners, the porters, the nurses, and I was shown where the fire exits were. And then I was left to it, to chair the Information Governance Committee.
Wow. What was that like on your first day or the first meeting? Like, what did that feel like?
I think, you know, that's one of the things I'm proudest of, that I was able to do it. But I do remember in those early days on the board that I would say things and the room would just fall silent and everyone would awkwardly shuffle their papers. And I'd think, I don't know what it was I said that I shouldn't have said, or I said it in the wrong way. I just didn't know. You know, there's a great formality to boards. There's a structure in the way that boards work, and a dynamics to those relationships that I was just not familiar with. I was familiar with running a business, making things happen, quite different.
Do you look back on those, any of those meetings now and go, oh, I realise why I said that and why the room went silent? Is there any, do you get it now?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I absolutely get it. And I think, oh, I have so much sympathy for that chair now. And now as a chair, I think, oh, I see some of those behaviours in other people, maybe newer board members, and I think, oh, now I understand. I understand where he was coming from. There's a way of doing this that works better than some of the other ways. So, yeah, again, that's come full circle.
Yeah, amazing. And when you think about some of the appointments that you've had, are there any particular outcomes or impacts that you can kind of tie back to your time in that organisation? You know, are there any particular things that you can kind of look on with pride in terms of what the organisations have done under your guidance?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, one of the things slightly off topic that I'm proudest of is having been a role model, I think, for women on boards. And so I went through two pregnancies and two rounds of breastfeeding while I sat on six boards at the time.
Nice.
I didn't have any maternity leave, and I would come to work at a board meeting sometimes with a helper in tow with a baby or even two babies who I was breastfeeding, who I would leave a board meeting to go and breastfeed.
Amazing.
And at the time, that was really pretty shocking to
Yeah.
some of the organizations that
But
I worked
even
for.
now, I mean, surprising or unusual, yeah.
Yeah. So I feel that it was very difficult. It was
Yeah.
very difficult for me to do that,
Yeah.
but I felt really determined on behalf of women to do it. I don't think you can say we want to have women on our boards and we want gender parity and we want equality if you're not prepared to back that up with the actions that are needed to get there. I mean, I can remember at one point I sat in a tribunal, and occasionally I would have to either leave to feed a baby or to use a breast pump. And I would say to the chairman of the tribunal, I need to leave the room. And he would go bright red and he would say to me, just do whatever you need to do. Just go. So I think I worked in an environment where, honestly, I would make people quite uncomfortable
Yeah.
quite often just by my presence. I was already a young woman, come from a working class background. Then I turned up with my breast pump, and I was very much the disruptive influence in a lot of the boards that I sat on.
Yeah. But as you say, what a wonderful thing to look back on and feel like you've made a difference in changing the culture and the understanding of women in boards as a result, and there will be ripple effects of that, won't there?
Oh yeah, 100%. When I was at Police Scotland, I joined the board just before we merged the police forces in Scotland into a single national force. And that's one of the hugest achievements of my career and the steepest learning curve I ever had. But I was the maternity champion for the board there and for Police Scotland as a whole. And again, a great position of privilege to be able to change things for women within the police force. It's so many of those kinds of things are what I feel are my biggest achievements.
Yeah.
Paving the way for others and making it easier for the people who come after, I think.
Yeah, fantastic. We've talked a little bit about some times that were tricky, already actually, but I wonder as you look back, what have been the hardest times, in your career? When's it felt really tough?
I think that Police Scotland merger was very tough. It was very high profile. Board members were on the front page of the newspaper in Scotland regularly. The merger was very controversial. And I was thrust into that board, having had some limited experience on my NHS board. This was a completely different kettle of fish, very much in the public eye. I can remember a particular board meeting. The board meetings are held in public and they were televised.
Oh.
And a particular board meeting where I think I was 8 months pregnant at the time, I thought, I have to pee maybe every half hour at
Yep,
the moment.
yep.
I'm on television. I've got a TV camera right next to my face in a very contentious board meeting in a public hall. And we had a hostile audience in the hall also. And I could tell during the meeting that people in the audience were tweeting about me. They were live tweeting. And sometimes they would say, here's this woman again who says nothing at these meetings. And then if I went to a meeting and I said something, then they criticize what I'd said at the meeting.
Oh.
And I can just remember sitting there thinking, I feel like a rabbit in the headlights. I feel so exposed.
Yeah.
And yet my position on this board is to deliver this merger for everyone concerned. And I was put here for a reason. It was really hard sometimes to keep going with that, I think. And I made board friends and colleagues on that board who saw me through those most difficult times. I've got relationships there that, I still call on these people all these years later because I think we feel we went through that together and
Yeah.
supported each other through that.
Yeah. So you've already mentioned that in some of those early board experiences, you had the scrutiny of the other board members and the chair and, you know, sort of trying to navigate that. And then in this next role, you had that public scrutiny very, very present and in your face, as you say. And it sounds like you're kind of in that position of damned if you do, damned if you don't. What was it like kind of going home after a day like that? How would you decompress or deal with it?
I think it was quite exhausting, but I would say that there are times still now that I come home from work and think, that's quite a difficult job and quite a long day. And I found that as the chair, it's taken me back to the feelings of some of those earlier non-exec experiences where I felt so exposed and so out of my comfort zone and people are looking at you.
Yeah.
Well, as the chair, people are always looking at you. They're always looking to you for the leadership and they're always looking at you to see what you're doing. So I think, again, I've gone through a period since I've moved up from being a non-exec to chair of feeling exposed again and coming home and thinking, wow, that was, you know, that was intense. That was a long day.
We talk, don't we, about, you know, growth happens at the edge of your comfort zone and you know, stepping into those things that make you feel uncomfortable is how you kind of continue to progress, make an impact. And it sounds like you really, through your career, you've made a whole load of steps which have been uncomfortable at the time. And then you've settled into that and then moved on to the next thing. Do you kind of like the feeling of being on the edge of what's comfortable, or what's kind of driving you to keep making those steps, I guess?
I think I do. I think enjoy is probably the wrong word, but I think that I embrace as best I can.
Yeah.
That edge, where can I get to and what can I do next, I think is important to me. I mean, one of the things that I did quite early on was join an organisation called Women on Boards. Mm. And they're a phenomenal support to me through my board career. And I eventually went to work with them as part of my portfolio. I worked with them delivering workshops to mid and senior level women on how to get your first board position and why you would want to do that.
Yeah.
And I think that that has also really... it's really driven me and I enjoyed it so much because I feel I've had so much out of having that portfolio career really early. Mm. I know some of those experiences have been challenging. You're right, it's all about growth. And so I still encourage women all the time. They'll often say to me, I'm too young to think about that. I'm too young to get a board position. That's for when I retire or that's for when I'm more experienced. You're never too young. We've had people in Women on Boards. I appointed someone to one of my boards who was 18.
Oh.
And just think of the phenomenal experience they're getting in governance that I wish I'd had when I went onto my NHS board.
But also, what a different perspective to bring to your board to have an 18-year-old. I mean, that must be incredibly disruptive in a good way, I would have thought.
Yeah, 100%. So I think that... this idea of boards being more diverse, we've made some progress, but we've still got a long way to go on that in terms of diversity. But, you know, I would just encourage listeners to think, oh, is there something that I can do now to start prepping for my portfolio career, thinking about my board career?
Yeah. And actually, yeah, if we sort of move into that, because I like to spend some time on this podcast thinking about what advice would you give? What advice would you give to somebody who is mid to kind of getting into the end of their career or starting to at least open their minds to what they might do towards the end of their career and thinking, yeah, I might do some board work when I'm in my, I don't know, like late 50s or 60s or something. What would you say to them? You'd begin perhaps by just challenging them on that assumption, would you?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a board for everyone, and being on a board will always add something to your career and your personal development because it's a different way of looking at things. You're almost on the other side of the table and you can't pull all the levers that you can pull when you're an executive. You know, I remember my favorite chair once saying to me, oh, it's great. I look down and I see all these levers and I pull on them. And then I realize they're not connected to anything. And that's what being a chairman on executive is all about. How do I satisfy myself, do my job, drive the strategy, drive the governance without any of the levers that an executive has? I turn up once a month and I have to somehow do that.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting intellectual challenge, and the people skills that you'll learn from it, the influencing, the communication, stakeholder engagement, it's phenomenal. Honestly, I can't recommend it enough. And what I do often say to people is to take a very small part-time position to start with and do it in something you're interested in. Become a school governor at your children's school. If there's a sport you like, participate on a board around that sport, a charity cause that you're passionate about. Having that real interest in whatever the subject of the organisation is, I think really helps too.
Yeah. So begin with something small and somewhat closer to home, perhaps.
Yes.
And really just lean into it as the experience itself. What can you learn from it? How can you grow from it? How can you bring those skills back to the rest of your career? And see how it develops. What if somebody is in a more kind of active position of, okay, I'm ready to do a bit of a leap here. I'm ready to come out of my executive or senior level career, and I actually want to start building something where I continue to make a good living through non-executive work. What would your advice to that type of person be?
You know, the advice isn't vastly different, because that's quite a competitive marketplace and there are quite a lot of people thinking about that at that point in their lives. And I actually say the same thing to them. If you've never had board experience before, you need to go and get it, because for those paid board positions, you have to be able to demonstrate how you've sat at that side of the table.
Yes.
And if you've not done your first board position, you can't really demonstrate it, which is sort of why I say it's never too early to get started, because then you're building up your evidence for those paid positions. The other thing that's super key is the networking.
Yeah.
So many of the positions in the public sector and third sector, generally positions are all advertised, but the people who get those positions go through that process that's been advertised. And a lot of the time, the people who are appointed were known to the organisation already, or to the chair, or to a board member, or someone else who works there. It's just the nature of what we do. And it's the same for any job, executive, non-executive. A lot of it comes down to your network and the strength of those connections. So I think that it's really important to be thinking about that.
Yeah.
If you're going to go and have that portfolio career, what are you going to specialise in?
Yes.
And how do you start to build the relationships you need? That specialism is also really important. In a crowded marketplace, what do I want to be known for? Because there are so many people who can become a non-executive director without a niche, then you're making it much harder for yourself.
Yeah. And would that, what you become known for? I mean, presumably there might be certain sectors that you might specialize in. There might be certain types of organization. There might be certain problems or business challenges that the organization is going through that you particularly might specialize. I mean, there's a number of dimensions of specialism, I guess.
There is. And the other thing that you would often specialise in on a board is, what was your day job?
Yeah.
And so were you an accountant, a legal person, digital transformation, HR, whatever your technical specialism was, is ideal food for thinking about what your board specialism will be. Principally, boards will have two big committees that they'll look at. You'll have audit and risk, and then you'll have some sort of people committee with remuneration, nominations. And so if your career has been in people, you'll tend towards that people strand. And if your career has been in governance, audit, accountancy, risk, you'll go in that other stream. What I would say is, start thinking about this early. And what some people want to do in their portfolio career is to not do what they did in their day job.
Yeah.
And so you've got the option to say, okay, Okay, maybe I was an accountant. I don't really want to specialize in audit. I actually am really interested in transformation or another sector, whatever it might be. That's completely fine. But think ahead about that and make a plan about how you'll sell yourself.
Because, and also because these appointments are, a number of years, aren't they? And
Yes.
yeah, this is a long-term lead up to some of this, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And so that again, that's why I say you can't start too early with a position and getting your experience, but also with thinking about what will my specialism be? What's my board USP going to be? Because as a chair, when I go out to recruit someone for my board, I'm generally thinking, what problem do I have right now? Okay, it's digital transformation. Where do I find a board member who's dealt with that
Yeah.
at scale and who has experience of sitting on a board?
Yeah. That's really helpful information, I think, and very practical for people in that zone. I've seen you talk about the loneliness of being a chair on a board. Could you talk a little bit about that? Because I was interested in your thoughts on that.
Yeah, so I sat on a number of boards for a number of years when I started thinking about becoming a chair because it's the obvious progression from being a non-exec.
Yeah.
And still, after all my years of sitting on boards and my 10,000 hours in the boardroom, I thought it's a bit like a promotion from being a non-exec. It's a bit like being the lead non-exec, if you like.
Yeah.
And then I became a chair and I thought, oh my goodness. This feels like the loneliest job in the world because I'm not just a more senior non-executive. I'm part of the figurehead for this organization. And I've now become a line manager to a CEO and to a team of board members. And that's my job now. So my job is not to be, a more senior person with an opinion. My job is to become line manager to all these people and deal with all the interrelationships between them. So I think that that can be quite lonely, particularly because when you're a non-executive, you've got your board colleagues, your peers, you're all on the same level, you can discuss issues together. And at the end of the day, those issues are the chair's problem.
Yeah.
They're not your problem as a non-executive. That's a job where you can go home at night and pretty much switch off. And for the chair, it's not like that. And who do you go to say, oh, I've got this really complex issue. What should I do about it? Please help me, give me advice. Quite difficult to find people to talk to.
I mean, even just this, yeah, a sounding board, can I just share this with it? Somebody who understands or who can kind of resonate with the challenges. Did I see that you created, or you were part of creation of a network for board chairs to help them with this?
Yeah, so I was lucky that having been with women on boards for so many years, I had chairs that I could go to help me with some of these dilemmas. But because I'm in Scotland half the time and I thought, well, I'll join the Scottish group for chairs and I'll be able to speak to other people who understand that political context, environmental context. And there was no group. There was nowhere for chairs to come together in Scotland to talk to each other. And I thought, in my usual style, well, I better set one up then so
Yeah.
that they're how will I do that? So I set up Chair Circle for chairs to come together, principally to network and to talk to each other. But at every meeting we'll have a subject that we're thinking about through the chair's lens. The last meeting we talked about AI and what does the chair have to think about in terms of AI. That's been brilliant because it's brought people together and help to share some of that loneliness and some of that burden that the chairs feel
Yes.
and be a real support to one another. And it's great for me when I see people forming those relationships and then talking independently of that group. That's brilliant. That's what I set it up for.
And in so many, as I talk to so many leaders in sustainability in the, more of the E space or the S space, as well as the G that you've been talking about, that loneliness is a theme, So I've had people on here who've been the only person in their organization responsible for sustainability, and they may be quite senior, but it's just the one of them. And so I think that loneliness is is a theme in this work, because it is quite specialized. You know, there's just not so many in every organization. So I think always the advice or the conversation turns to that feeling of create the community. And if there isn't a community, you find it and you create it, because that helps so much. We've talked a lot about your wisdom and your advice for others. Is there anything else that you would like to share with our listeners that you've not had a chance to talk about? Is there anything else on your mind?
I think that in terms of sustainability, I've done some nearly all of my roles have been in this kind of triangle of social, environmental, and commercial. And I think that's where a lot of us operate, in that really tricky world of tension between those. And I think it's interesting that I've come full circle now to SEPA and chairing SEPA, and that's our fundamental triangle that we operate in. So we're there to protect the environment, but our statutory purpose also talks about driving economic growth. And so I think we still have this tension and question around how do we drive economic growth and the social value that that brings, but how do we do it while keeping the environment in mind? And so that's a tension that I think I've felt throughout my career and still very much feel now chairing this agency. How do we do that? How do we keep on purpose? But how do we help to support the economy of Scotland? I think it's a real challenge. We navigate situation by situation. But I do wonder sometimes about how do we sustain ourselves through that? And for me, it's going back to nature, going back to animals, to the things that I've always loved. I don't have as much time to do that now as I would have liked to have, but I still find that, you know, I work in London every week now, and I've got a friend who I met through a nature group who takes me swimming at Hampstead Heath in the ponds. And I think, wow, you know, that one afternoon, that will keep me going for weeks through lots of difficult meetings, through everything. I'll just think back, oh, when I was in the water, watching the swans swimming along, you know, things like that for me are a little oasis and a little reminder of why I do what I do.
Actually, that's a common thread in this podcast conversations, because people really just sort of reconnecting back with whatever it was initially that drew them into that work, whether it was, you know, for some it was more about water, the sea, for others it's more about animals, for others it's more about flora, fauna, others it's more about social inequality, and, you know, but whatever it was that brought you into it, that's a thing to kind of continually tap back into and reconnect with as that reminder. I think that's actually quite important, because as you say, you can, with all these trade-offs and tensions, you can get drawn quite far away from it if you are not intentional about it, I think.
Yeah, 100%. So I think that one of the key things that I did for myself several years ago was spent a bit of time figuring out my values. And I'm sure for some listeners, they know what their values are and they know them inside out. But if not, I'd really encourage you to do it. I think I read a book about it, but I'm sure there's lots of methods for doing it. It took me a surprising length of time to come up with the five that I ended up with, because I thought, oh, I like that one, I like that one, I like that one.
Yeah.
And it's very committing to pick some and say, these are the values for my life and these are the lens through which I will make decisions about what I do and don't do. But doing that that's been life-changing for me, I think. And now when I have those difficult decisions to make, I'll revisit them straight away. And one of them is nature. One of those values is nature. And so, yeah, it gives me that framework for making decisions, for getting through difficult times. And like you said, it's easy to be pulled off course. Very easy. And then before you know it, you turn around and you think, how did I get here? That wasn't quite where I was meant to be. And so having those values to test that against and say, am I living up to them? Am I getting enough of this one or that one? You know, another one's adventure. Am I getting enough adventure in my life? Maybe I feel a bit dull at the moment. I don't know. So So yeah, that's worked for me.
I have adventure on my list, actually, funnily enough. Yeah. It is a really valuable exercise. And yeah, you can kind of, as you say, there's lots of different methods and you can sort of do it. I've done it in the past where I've kind of looked at a list and just kind of looked at ones I feel drawn to. And I've also, there's a really nice card game type thing that I've done where you have a big old deck of cards and you kind of go through them and you sort them. The only danger with that is I ended up not with five, but with about 10 or maybe, and then like, can I just add this one in and can I add that one? And they're all quite appealing. When you do it that way, they have little cartoon pictures on that makes you go, yeah, I want that, I want more of that. But the way I actually, the way I do it with my clients is a bit different, and I do this is something we do like after we've been working together a few months. I don't do it at the beginning. We kind of peel back a few of the layers first before we get into it. And because often we can say, oh, my value is hard work, and actually when you dig around in that, it's not really your value. It's just something you've been told along the way and you've sort of gradually generally adopted it as your own without really examining, is that something that truly kind of lights you up or fires you up? So yeah, the way I do it is like more of a bottom up where I just get my client to kind of talk about what they love for a really long time, and I take notes and then I sort of play it back to them, and then we sort of gradually refine it down to a list. But yeah, we take about at least half an hour, maybe an hour of talking, and then sort of pull it out that way, which is quite a nice way of doing it, but really, really important, and then really helps with the decision making. You know, if you're sort of weighing up between a few different jobs, okay, what do I really love? And yeah, reminding yourself.
And I think when I have that feeling that life's going off track, it helps me have a framework to look at it and say, where has it gone off track and what am I missing here? And so one of my other values is family, and that's been very important to me. I mentioned about my father before, and growing up I've cared for three relatives at end of life, and you know, a single parent, two children. So that family value is hugely important to me, and a foundation in those. Then I think I would say with those values, it can be really difficult also sometimes because they're in conflict. You know, you can have your values and then what do you do when a decision is maybe in conflict with family or in conflict with nature? So I think that is just the nature of life.
Yes, but I think helpful to whittle it down to, okay, these are the five areas of tension that I'm going to focus on. You know, I'm going to sort of focus on exploring that, and I'm not going to sort of necessarily get drawn down a path that might be driven by somebody else's values or somebody else's drive. That's fascinating though, and it sounds like you've got those five quite either clear in your head or close to hand, and you really know them.
I probably use them every day. One of the things about being a chair and a board member and having a portfolio career with other things in it is just decisions. I'll say this sometimes to friends, no more questions, please, no more questions. I feel like from 7 a.m. until 10 o'clock every night, it's questions and decisions all the time. And so it's really nice for me to sometimes just have a day off and think, no questions today, just no questions. I can just be.
Yes. And decision fatigue is very, I mean, I remember a period where I was doing quite a lot of, there was decision making at work. It was a period of quite a lot of that at work. And at the same time, I was renovating my house. And there's nothing like a house renovation to literally just bombard you with decisions like, what kind of radiator do you want? What's the colour of the window? And literally every day you're doing it. And when that period ended and the renovation ended, I just remember being like, I'm not going to make another decision again for as long as I can manage. I'm going to just avoid it for so long because I was just exhausted from it. It's really hard. And yeah, you're doing this every day.
Yeah. Yes, wow. The decision fatigue is real. Very occasionally my children will say to me, oh, why are you being so grumpy today? And I say, I've just reached a level of questions. So when I was a child, I was very inquisitive. You know, I was probably designed to be a board member. I asked my questions early, but all day long I would say, but why, and what about this, and what about that? And my mother used to invoke the tartan monkey, and she said, you've got a quota of questions for the day. And today's quota is 10. And once you've asked your 10, the answer to every question will be tartan monkey. And so...
So she really encouraged you to be careful with your questions 100%. As well. You've got to make those questions count. If you've only got 10, you can't just be firing it off all the time. Wow, that's incredible. And how now, you know, that skill is present in your daily life.
Yeah, in the boardroom. It all started with the tartan monkey.
So if you want to raise a child who goes on to become chair of a board, you have to give them a question quota and get them to really, really learn the art of a great question. Yeah. Fantastic. Yeah.
And now I have a child, a daughter who's 11. She's autistic. She is a force of nature. And she came home from school recently to say to me, "Mummy, I've been made the chair of the school action group." I said, Wow.
Oh my goodness. That's incredible. So she's really following in the footsteps there.
She started young. It's never too young to have your first board position.
Never too young. Start age 11. Perfect age. Wonderful. What a role model she is for all of us now then. Oh, well, I think we should probably draw our conversation to a close, although I feel like we could talk a lot more. I'd love to talk a lot more with you. But yeah, I want to say thank you for taking the time to join me on the podcast. And I feel like our listeners will really get a lot of value from the experiences you've shared and given us that insight into a role that is so important, challenging, but also you've helped us challenge some of the assumptions about when we might begin this type of work and the importance of diversity in the boardroom. So yeah, thank you so much, Lisa, for joining me on the podcast.
Very welcome. Thank you.
Well, what a conversation that was. I found Lisa to be absolutely inspiring, and I'm coming away from the conversation thinking maybe I need to investigate making a start in this type of career. If it's even something that you're pondering on that you might want to do later in life, I think Lisa's advice is really useful. Make a start, do something small, do something that you enjoy and is aligned to your interests. So I'm going to be going away and giving that quite a lot of thought, I think. I also love the fact that Lisa is a single mum and has talked to us about, you know, breastfeeding in the boardrooms and bringing small children into boardrooms and really shown us what's possible as a woman, what's possible as a mother, what's possible as a younger person, and that the kinds of skills that you bring into the boardroom are super important, and boards and chairs of boards don't want a whole group of clones sitting around the table. They want diversity of thought, they want diversity of experience and diversity of opinion. So I feel really inspired listening to that conversation. I hope you do too. I would love to hear what you think about it. Please message me or put a comment on a LinkedIn post and tell me what you think, or put a comment underneath the podcast and do all that stuff that we need you to do. If you like this podcast, do the like and the subscribe and the follow and the tell your friends about it. If you know anybody in your life who has mentioned to you that they might want to lean into a portfolio career or board work in their career, then please send this to them, because I think it will be really valuable listening. So thanks once again for being a part of the Rooted community, and I'll see you again next time. Bye-bye.